Happy New Year and welcome to Talk of Alaska, the first show of 2017. I'm Steve Heimel. Our issue today is the northern differential in climate warming. You're seeing it. Tell us what you're seeing. Science is looking for this data. Major conferences on these issues are about to start. Research money's tight. Where should it be spent? Call now at 1-800-478-8255, toll-free from anywhere in Alaska, and Anchorage a local call at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. Scientists, join us in just a moment on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
The world of science has decided that our planet has been irreversibly altered by human activity, and a new geological era has begun. They're now down to arguing about what will be the marks of this era in some future layer of ground. Now, perhaps such disputes might persuade you that science is something somehow unconnected with our daily concerns. Well, not if you can't insure your home because of storm surge. Not if your loan payment depends on how much halibut you're allowed to catch. Not if your family just lost a beloved elder who fell through the ice at a time when it's always been solid before. Then science is suddenly very immediate. Science is going to set your halibut quota, help us nail down our risk of storm surges and violent weather, and it's going to be needed to direct our investments toward more community resilience. So we have a bunch of science conferences that are coming up. The Marine Science Symposium in Alaska starts on the 23rd. And meanwhile, over in Germany, an outfit called the Earth League is going to have a meeting. And we're joined with one of the organizers of this Earth League gathering from Potsdam, Germany. We're speaking with Dr. Professor Wolfgang Lucht of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. And before you say anything, Wolfgang, I'm going to go ahead and give some of your credentials. You're co-chair of the Department of Earth System Analysis at the Potsdam Institute. You are the holder of the Alexander von Humboldt Chair on Sustainability Science at Humboldt University, and you are a member of the German government's Advisory Council on the Environment. And in no way are you appearing in your official government capacity on this program, because we're going to be speculating all over the place. Wolfgang Lucht, welcome to Talk of Alaska. How are you doing today, this evening?
Very well. It's evening here in Germany, and it's my pleasure to be talking to you in Alaska.
Yes, I'm really glad that you could, it's evening for you, so we're talking to you at home and that you can make the time to participate in this conversation. I understand you're somewhat acquainted with Alaska, but I wanted to speak to you about this this Earth League and what in the world it is.
Well, it's a club, so to speak, of, at this point, 16, soon 20 eminent scientists from all over the world. They are very well-known people, including Nobel Prize winners like Mario Molina, very influential people who lead big institutes. And they thought that there is a need that they have serious discussions about the more, finding new pathways into new science and making sure that the mainstream of science doesn't lead to important other things falling off of the agenda. And also they would like to help in communicating some of the new science in a very timely manner, not always waiting for those long cycles that the United Nations panels report and so on. And I'm an associate member of the Earth League. They produce papers, and they meet from time to time and then think about what's at stake and what research should be tackling.
So there's you don't have to look too deep into climate science to realize that there are tipping points. You know, we probably have some feedbacks going on in the Arctic, for instance, that are way beyond what the models predicted. And so I think knowing that, one has to go back and look at the social aspects, not only about the communities and how they're impacted, but also in terms of what sort of human actions can be done to mitigate things. In other words, where should our priorities be? If we're trying to cut down on carbon, how do we do it? And the scientists, it seems, don't always have that active a voice in the policy side of things. So it seemed to me that the Earth League was trying to get over more to the policy side of things. Would that be accurate?
Yeah. I mean, we are all Earth system scientists, and it's a very fascinating job to have because you can think about these fascinating things, the planet and life and how things evolved over time and what it all means. It's really fascinating, but then you get all these new results on your desk, and a lot of them really makes us very, very concerned because, you know, sometimes you think, are we maybe a little bit always looking at those worst cases, and then new data come in, new modeling results come in, and they show that a lot of stuff is starting to happen that is pretty worrisome. And so it's pretty certain from our perspective now that we're at a very critical point and time is running out. So we're trying to convey a lot of that science, including its uncertainties, but always emphasizing that with all the uncertainties, we know so much already to not be speculating anymore. And since time is running out, the question is, how can civilization react to that? How can our societies react to that? And what's the responsibility we have at a time when issues of justice and participation and economic development are so important for so many people on this planet? So what's the path to the future that doesn't run the risk of taking the Earth to a place we probably don't want it to go?
That's, I think,
and
justice.
So we're discussing these twin issues, yeah, that in the Earth system there are many things that don't go smoothly, but there are thresholds somewhere where big things could tip into some other state and have really big consequences. And those are out there. We are not there yet, but we're approaching them. And at the same time, in order to avoid that, we probably have to change some things in the way we produce our energy and the way we build in a very fundamental manner. And that has to happen rapidly as well. So we have to have, like, a tip towards a new phase of civilization, modernization, a look to the future in order to avoid some of the bad tipping that happens in the Earth system, or at least there's a danger of it happening. And that's all different from issues of very smooth, gradual development that takes time. So this is what we're going to discuss, how social change can be accelerated in order to avoid the rapid change that we're seeing in the Earth system, at least the worst instances of it.
Very, very eloquent summary there, Wolfgang. He's speaking of the upcoming gathering later this month of the Earth League in Potsdam. And we're asking Lassen's call up to discuss Arctic science and what their observations are in priorities and resilience and whatever else comes up at 1-800-478-8255 or a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. The statewide toll-free number again, 800-478-8255. And, you know, Mark and Bethel, I'll get to your call in just a second, but I want to introduce our second panelist, who is Zachary Laib, an atmospheric scientist at the University of California, Irvine. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Zach.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm very happy to have you on the program. I wanted to talk to you particularly because I wanted somebody that's tracking the sea ice in the Arctic Ocean at this very moment. The forecast for the air temperature in Utqiagvik, formerly Barrow, was 36 degrees on the 1st of January, 36 degrees.
Right.
And we seem to have had like a couple of waves or pulses, lobes, I guess you could call them, of warm air that has gone over the Arctic Ocean, particularly over on the Svalbard side. And just like, I heard that the ice went out around Svalbard in a day. We've seen this the last 3 years, and we saw it last year particularly, but we seem like we're seeing even more Arctic melt in the winter of the in the middle of winter this year than ever before.
Right. It's interesting. So Arctic weather is very variable. So you get these, as you said, pulses of warm air that come from both the Pacific and Atlantic sides of the Arctic. But particularly this fall, we've seen these pulses happen every 2 or 3 weeks. And in response to those warm pulses, we see ice then slow down as far as freezing or even melt, as you suggested, near Svalbard. We saw that.
Yep. Did we just lose a cell phone connection? gotta love those cell phones. Okay, well we'll just hope that we that his power didn't run out. Thank you so much. We were speaking with Zachary Leib at the University of California, Irvine, and he's keeping up on sea ice with active sensing. And it's the subject of his PhD work, and hopefully we'll be getting back to that. We also have Wolfgang Lucht of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research with us. And joining us by phone from Bethel is Mark. I told you I'd get to you, Mark. Here you are. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Happy New Year. Nice to hear you this morning.
Happy New Year, Mark.
So, thanks. So I moved to Alaska. I moved to Tok in 1976, and it was 70 below all the time. I went to college in Fairbanks, left there in 81, I guess. It was 70 below all the time in the winter. And what was really remarkable was the interior was always just flat, calm. And a few years ago, it sounded like, I wasn't there, but it got, you know, I had a big enough windstorm in Tok. It sounded like they had a doggone tornado go through there. The interior has gotten real windy. One thing that I'd certainly observed out here in Bethel is some real significant changes in moisture patterns. The first time I went to Hooper Bay, there was snow to the top of the roofs in May after college was out. And now the whole YK Delta is just bare tundra after this warm weather we've had. We had a week of 35 plus. So I'm kind of interested in these changes in moisture pattern flows. The talk about pulses of warm air coming over the poles. I'm kind of interested in how the kind of the sharpened curvature of the Earth, the further north you get, affects airflow patterns and how much changes in the jet stream, what has happened with the jet stream that's pushing certainly all the cold air down in the lower 48. And there's times when I think they can have it, but there's times when it'd be kind of nice to get it back.
Yeah, Mark, aren't we all? Aren't we all? Yeah. Thanks for that. That is Zach's area of specialization, if we can just get him back on his cell phone, but hadn't happened yet.
Yeah, I've got just a couple of quick questions for your guests there. One is, what do they view as the importance of beta rescue? And that's, you know, old information that's been gathered in places that it wasn't necessarily taken scientifically, but it's valid, like ship log books, and whether there'd be an analog between the Kliwok project. I'm sure your guest from Potsdam knows about that. And maybe trying to gather data from Bering Sea, shipping and fishing and military records. And the other real big question is, okay, I'd like to hear somebody talk about the conflict between basic ongoing research on climate and the drive for social change agendas, and mixing up in that research and what sort of conflicts that creates within funding agencies, whether it's the United States Congress or the European Union or the state of Alaska. So thanks a lot, Steve.
Or China, Mark, or China.
China.
All right. Thanks. A very thoughtful man. I should have talked to you to focus this show. 1-800-478-8255, the phone number, or 550-8422 if you're in Anchorage. It's a local call. Otherwise, statewide, 800-478-8255. We're talking about climate science and probably more about the Marine Science Symposium that will be coming up in Anchorage at the Captain Cook Hotel on the 23rd. So Professor Wolfgang Lucht of Potsdam Institute is with us, and you just heard what Mark said. Let's start with the reconstruction efforts. I know a lot of scientists are very interested in that. I know they go back to, like, for instance, fossil wildlife, even to get samples of contaminants and things like that. And he was talking about, well, how about reconstructing things from old records and making them match up with our current observations. How is that going?
Yeah, I mean, this is really, really important, and it's fascinating because, you know, modern instruments haven't been around for that long, for a few decades, in some cases more than a century, but that's still just one century. And when you see changes, you always want to know, have there been similar changes previously, or is this a new phenomenon? Or if you see something that's happening in the last 10 years, you want to know, are there some cycles? And so you need time series of data, and often they are not available. So scientists have created so many fascinating ways of inferring by some indirect method what previous states of climate might have been in order to construct previous states of the Earth or some locations. And particularly, a big problem is the spatial resolution. If you want to know what happened in a certain area, because then you can deduce what the air currents might have been or whether the ocean currents were any stronger or weaker or different. And so all of these bits of information are really valuable. Actually, there's like a fun example. In England, there used to be a habit in previous times of collecting birds' eggs. And so there are these big collections of bird eggs, and a lot of them are with detailed notes about when they were collected and, like, what day they went to the nest to get that egg. And so then you can reconstruct when the birds were breeding, and then you can see, you know, where that compares to times from today. So there's all sorts of fascinating sources.
Yeah, that's good, Wolfgang. And that's you like that area, how the biosphere responds, right? I mean, that's kind of in your right in your ballpark, right?
Yeah, I kind of figure that we live in landscapes, and that's what matters most to us. Somehow people are fascinated by physics and climate and sea ice and all that. But in the end, I think we care about the landscapes that we inherited and that we're used to and that we use. And that's the world of the living things.
Yeah, and I think phenology is, we've had nice discussions of phenology from time to time on this program, because it can be so heartbreaking when you get the hatch at the same time that hit at the wrong time in terms of the food supply because of something that's changed in the climate. But that's happening all over the place. And I guess the emerging question we have now is what's going on with genetics? Because apparently in some cases, evolution is proceeding much faster than your geneticists thought it would. And, in a biological...
It's starting to shift.
Yeah.
I mean, we have to realize we're still at the beginning of these changes. Some of them emerge slowly. And, I mean, we are on that upward swing of change, but we're still in the early phases. And I think in 30 years from now, we'll see a lot of the things we're starting to see so strongly that I don't think we will have a discussion about whether climate change is real and all that stuff that is being discussed in the public, because it will be obvious to everybody.
Yeah, but the question of what to do about it remains, and the other part of Mark's question, which I'm not going to get to right now, the justice side of it. In other words, is the third world entitled to take the same development path that the first world did? And, where's the justice in all that? And I know a lot of people think about that, and it really does lie in the policy area ultimately. Let's get back to a little harder science. Zach Labor, are you back with us?
Yes, I am. Sorry about that.
Oh, it's all right. That stuff happens with cell phones. That's why I try and avoid them. Yeah. Well, we got the first call that came in was right down your alley, and it was about the wandering jet stream and the what's the latest on that? And I know that's the subject. That's where you're trying to go. So
right.
Maybe you can give me some idea of why isn't it? I mean, Jennifer Francis explained this a couple of years on this program, 3 years, 4 years ago, and it seemed quite obvious, you know, the temperature differential is less, the jet stream would wander more, but scientists find that to be a controversial theory. What do you think?
Right. So one of the reasons it might be known as controversial is how do we sort of define a wobbly jet? So if we're trying to replicate a warming Arctic and then also see a wobbling jet in response, we look at the climate models. But how to quantify such a wobbly jet is one of the challenges. So a lot of scientists have tried different metrics on how do we quantify a wobblier jet or more extreme Arctic blasts or warm periods. And it's difficult to replicate in some of the climate models, and it's also difficult to really find statistical significance in the observation.
There went the... Oh, man. This is really frustrating. Let's go to Joe, joins the program from Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Joe.
Hi.
How you doing?
Pretty good. I'd like to interject something a little different here. From my perspective, and I'm not a young guy, I've seen the world change physically in front of me. I've seen places that were once wilderness are now subdivisions, and I've watched this for 70, 80 years. And so I've come to the conclusion that chasing down the climate change or resource depletion or any of these things that are secondary is going down a false path. What we really have to do is we have to find some way to stop the population growth. That's the exponential part. And that exponential part is the thing that goes on, and nobody addresses it.
I mean, Oh, yes, they do.
Oh, no. There's lip service to it. Talk to anybody in the street.
Well,
that's
yeah.
That's how you can find out. Ask them, you say, is there global warming? They'll say yes. If you say population's out of control, they go, no.
No. Well, I see your point there.
They
yeah,
do
but,
not understand it.
Yeah, but,
they
I mean, the cooler heads on this, the economic justice issue cuts into this one as well, as you probably know. When people's circumstances improve, and when women are more empowered, you get a lower birth rate.
That's a terrific theory, but it turns out not to be so.
Really? Tell that to the Germans.
If you go to the UN, you get those numbers, yes. But if you go around and you actually look to see about immigration and you watch to see, I do this, watch to see what happens to people, see how they count, and you'll discover that these families of 12 and 8 and 9, these families are growing the population, no matter what anyone
says.
There's
no dispute about that. But they, yeah, but that's that proves my point. You're talking about immigration now. I'm talking about birth rate.
I'm talking about the movement of population so that you can't count them. You cannot count them. That's
oh, I see. I see. So you can't really get the data.
No, you can't get the data. It's a very difficult data to get.
I see.
And I can tell you that when I've looked at specific situations, I've been in this for 40 years. When I look at specific situations, I see people making counts that are like 10% of what the true count is. And so I'm saying, if that's what's going on in this microcosm, what's going on in the world, and why do people recognize this is the exponential problem?
Yeah. Joe.
Someone has got to address that seriously.
Yeah.
Nobody does. I'm
really glad you do, because whenever we talk about the issue of climate change, somebody always brings up population, and I'm really glad that you approached it, and I'm sure that Wolfgang Lucht has heard it before.
I talked to an environmentalist professor, I don't know who he was, in Germany.
Yeah.
And he didn't recognize the problem in this theory.
Okay, well, let's see what Wolfgang...
Accommodation.
Let's see what Wolfgang has to say about it.
Well, it certainly is true that we've never had 7.5 billion people on this planet like we have now. So in 1950, it was something like 2.7 billion. So the increase is just immense. And that consumes environment and resources is obvious. The big thing is, you know, what do you want to do about it? The only thing that one can imagine is, you know, draconian measures that are not really free and democratic and all that. So that's if that's off of the table, which it should be, then the only path really is the thing you hinted at, Steve, is that, you know, education and better opportunity and generally a more stable life will probably lead to declining populations. But we haven't reached the peak yet. And
all
so
right.
This is the big issue. Some of the United Nations population projections, they think we will go up to about 9 or 10 billion. And then because of increasing prosperity on the planet, if that actually should be the case, one would think that the population kind of stabilizes. And there are indications that we're going into that direction.
Yeah.
But the uncertainty is huge, and it could certainly be much more also.
Yeah, and I think part of what
Joe was... But that's not the whole story. It's not the main... It's one important part, but the other part is, of course, the level of consumption we afford, like the, what every individual of us consumes and what level we have, leave a footprint on the environment. So both of these together are the whole story.
Yeah, and I think one thing that Joe was bringing up was the scant data. He thinks of we're just not doing a great job of even knowing what our population is. That could be.
Well, I think we have a good idea generally. I mean, 100 million more or less don't really make a huge difference.
100 million here, 100 million there.
The problem right now is that when the environment really gets into big shifts, I mean, we have a lot of problems on this planet. We have really big challenges to civilization, so to keeping the peace, increasing justice, producing the opportunity. So all these aspirations that people rightfully have to a good life in some way. Now, if we're going to solve those problems, at least for a lot of people, and make progress, that's going to be very, very difficult. So the last thing we need, so that's a challenge in itself. So the last thing we need on top of that is an environment that is really starting to slip and rainfall patterns shifting and, you know, things drying out. So actually our opportunity to the probability of humanity being able to meet that challenge of such high numbers is much better without environmental change on top of it.
Yeah, yeah, the carrying capacity.
In some ways.
Yeah, the carrying capacity is probably going down, like, for instance, phosphorus and salt appearing in irrigation areas. You know, there's a bunch of things that drought that are probably making the carrying capacity less than it was.
But can I say something about the justice, Stephen? The thing is, we had this climate conference in Marrakesh a few weeks ago, which was the first conference following after the big Paris Climate Agreement. And an interesting thing happened. A coalition of 48 nations amongst the 200 of the world went forward and said that they will do more than all the rest. They will go completely to renewable energy by 2050. And those were, if you go through the list, those were many of the poorest nations we have on the planet. So they're not going that route. Now it's our historical right to go to coal and oil. But they say, you know, we don't want to spend all our money on expensive oil and gas, and we're not going to take responsibility for a changing climate because we will be the countries that will be impacted by that change. We think there's a great democratic and participatory opportunity by distributed energy systems that are much more resilient and robust and that are local to these places. And we will commit ourselves to, you know, not repeating the 20th century, but actually moving to the forefront of the 21st century, when suddenly the combustion engine looks pretty old, because there are much smarter ways of doing electricity than burning something. And so they committed to that, and those are poor nations. Those are not the rich nations that are leading that particular initiative.
Wolfgang Lutz, that is probably the most inspirational thing we're going to hear on the show all day. Thank you so much. And I don't know why I didn't read about this Marrakesh thing someplace. You know, I try and go to enlightened sources for my news, but somehow no correspondent saw fit to send me a dispatch on that one.
The thing is that it was the week that Donald Trump got elected, and of course this would have been the perfect opportunity for countries around the world to jump off of the climate agreement, because to say, you know, it's difficult for all the countries. I mean, Germany is trying to go to renewable energy as an industrial nation, and it's making great progress. But it's difficult under the best of circumstances. It's necessary. It's not easy.
Right.
And so this would have been the perfect opportunity to take that as an excuse to say, well, you know, now everything's up in the air. We don't know what the Americans are going to do, so we won't do anything either, and we're going to wait. But the opposite happened. I mean, even China reaffirmed its commitment to do something. And as I said, these poorer nations said, no, we're stepping up our commitments because we think it's absolutely crucial for our development. You know?
Thank you. Thank you. Zach Labe, are you back with us now with your cell phone?
Yes, I'm back.
Thanks a lot. We were on it. It's sort of a fragmented, jagged collage program today, I'd say. But I did want to get back to this business about the jet stream and the modeling of it. What is your research thrust there at UC Irvine?
Well, right now I'm sort of working on a side project. So what I'm looking at is if we're having changes in the atmosphere.
I just love it. You know, Mr. Murphy is in charge of this. That's the way it is. Maybe we should just go ahead and take our break right now.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com. Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettisworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
The University of Alaska Southeast is open for business to all Alaskans. 2017 is your year to finish a degree and increase your earning power with online courses in business, accounting, and management. Explore the options online at uas.alaska.edu/SOM. This message sponsored by UAS.
It's Talk of Alaska. Howdy, friends. I'm Steve Heimel, and I'm happy to be talking about science and climate warming and our changing world. And we got calls coming in. We have been trying to talk with a sea ice guy by the name of Zachary Labe, who's on a cell phone, but we keep getting disconnected. I think, Zach, I'm sorry, we're just going to have to give up on that and stick with the people of Alaska who are calling in and Wolfgang Lutz Lucht, who is with the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. And joining us from Bethel, patiently waiting, is Helen. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Helen.
Thank you. Happy New Year to everybody.
Happy New Year.
I've been studying climate change for the past year, and one of the contributing factors is of the 55 million in America, we throw too much trash, and it's affecting the fish that help the big land animals from prospering and making our land less feasible for the big land animals. And one of the things that's affecting us is the lack of we're losing fish, we're losing trout, we're losing king salmon, silver, red salmon, chum, pink salmon, because we're overfishing our fish and throwing trash. Too many people, we're overpopulating the land. And China and India, they're overfishing our fish, and that's affecting our big land animals. And we need to recycle and quit throwing so much trash. We shouldn't throw them in the river or the ocean, because the glaciers are melting, and there's more water, and there's fish up here that's not supposed to be in Alaska, and even birds that come up here, they're migrating here because it's warmer. And I've seen swallows, and swallows aren't supposed to come to a spring, and it's January. Canadian birds, Canadian blue jays, are coming to Alaska because we're warming. That's all I had to say. Thank you.
Helen, thank you. That was a heck of a lot. 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. And I think we'll go to Norma in Marshall. Norma, are you still with us? We lost her. That's what happens. You take the break, and they say, oh, show must be over. No, show not over. Telephone number, 1-800-478-8255. Well, Wolfgang Lucht, we just heard a very compelling summary there from somebody who's just sitting there on the tundra watching all this happen, watching the fish change, watching different birds showing up, and thinking, well, we're kind of wasteful. Pretty hard to argue with that.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's very fascinating to hear the callers calling in and reporting such change because, you know, they see things that I don't see here in Germany. By the way, Potsdam is close to Berlin, if somebody's wondering. So I think this is really important observations. Now, it's a fact that, of course, humans are changing the planet. Not all change necessarily has to be bad. I mean, you know, things develop and so on. And we're not going to be able to undo or stop all the changes, but it should not exceed a certain threshold, a certain limit, because if we push it too far and we just let it run, then maybe the changes will get much bigger than we think, because the future will be really different from the past. We will not be able to take our experiences of the past to predict what the future will be. We're really going into a very new age. And so in that sense, we have to be worried. But it's always a bit difficult when you hear all these really dramatic messages, which are just what's happening. It's in some ways, it's the truth. But it's not too late to limit that change. So we still can do something. And we should not just give up and be desperate, but do something for positive change. And then see the big opportunities in that. Because Alaska has a lot of oil, say. So, you know, oil is easy for you. But for most places on Earth, they don't have oil. And they, like Germany, we have to spend so much money on importing oil from Russia and from Venezuela and from Arabia. Who wants to spend their money and send it to some other countries, many of which are problematic countries politically? It would be wonderful to have an alternative energy source.
Yeah. Well, and, yeah, also, I have to say
about automobiles now.
Yes.
I mean, this idea of putting a little fire into a little combustion chamber and exploding something, and that drives the energy. I mean, no animal has a little fire burning in it. It's all electrical gradients. It's all molecular stuff that creates the energy of life. And we're still doing it with fire. So maybe it's time to move into the 21st century and use new technologies that are not built around combustion of fossil fuels.
Eric, our engineer.
It might just be a good opportunity for development that actually has a lot more promise than sticking to those old ways that were successful last century but are not going to be successful in this century.
Well, you're
not for all people.
Wolfgang, you're getting a big nod from Eric, our engineer on the other side of the glass, who rode his bicycle in here to work today and temperatures in the single digits. And I took public transportation, but I'm a notorious bicyclist myself, and Eric and I both agree that people have just entirely too many explosions right now. So it's great to hear you say that. I mean, people sit around on top of all these damn explosions.
There's a discussion whether after 2030, cars with combustion engines will not be registered anymore. So the cars that exist, and that's not, you know, that's not government policy yet, but it's starting to be seriously discussed. And of course, that requires that electric cars get ramped up quickly, and that we have other modes of transportation. Public transportation has to be completely revolutionized. Maybe the self-driving cars are important, and the energy for those electric cars needs to be produced from renewable sources, at least in Germany.
Yeah, and you, but Germany is what, like 80-odd% of its electric power now is coming from coming from renewable sources.
No, not yet. We're up to 32% approximately right now of the electricity. It's about 15% of all energy that's being used. So there's still a lot of coal, even in Germany. We're not there yet. And actually, they're slowing down progress a little bit. The thing is, many years back, people thought that transitioning away from fossil fuels is basically impossible for economic reasons, cost reasons, all that. And then somehow a dynamic started, and suddenly the thing really started developing quickly, and it's getting cheaper and cheaper and more feasible, and everybody has their solar panels on the roof, and they've got lots of windmills in the landscape and so on. And then, you know, things start galloping and having their own dynamics. And so now actually they're slowing it down a bit because you need different electricity networks and so on.
Yeah.
And there are very powerful interests that try to slow it down.
Yeah, we have the same thing here.
At this point, because it just makes more sense.
Yeah, the same thing here. We have utilities that don't want to accept power that's generated not in their system. They say, well, it's not compatible. We don't have those kind of computers. They have a million excuses for not accepting that power. And it's interesting to see the same thing happening there in Germany, which, you know, I tend to think of as being civilized, but maybe not.
No, it's a little. I mean, it's important because in Germany has 80 million people. It's one of the leading industrial nations of the world. And if Germany can demonstrate that it can be done, I think a lot of people will pay attention. But, you know, we're still on the path towards proving it. But it's government policy to do that. 2050 is the target. A little fun fact, maybe because that conference you were talking about in the beginning that we're having in Potsdam later this month, this will be in a new building we have, a huge scientific research building, and the whole building is powered by the exhaust heat of our supercomputer. So this is also a way of doing it. Computers produce a lot of heat, and we're using it to power the building. And actually, the computer produces a lot more heat than we need to heat the building, even in winter.
Man, that must be some computer. That's all I got to say. Do you think we might
do a lot of computer simulation.
Yeah.
The computer is a big one, and it produces a lot of heat. And the problem actually is getting the heat out of the processors and dissipating it.
Wow.
So, you know, that's never been done, you know, in most buildings. So, you know, we built it into the new building.
So what do you think, you know, we have an outfit that's trying to lay a fiber optic across the across the Arctic Ocean now, and they will be doing the Alaska coast because they have a local partner. The other outfit doesn't seem to quite have the money yet, but still, it's quite an interesting idea to have that sudden connectivity. And there are those who think that the northern latitudes, the really cold places, might be good places to put server capacity once you have really good broadband access. What do you think?
Well, certainly the connectivity that is developing on this planet is a fascinating thing, and who knows how it will play out. I mean, opinions are being formed in different ways today than they used to be. We used to read the big newspapers to see what the discussion is, and maybe we accept some of the arguments, but now there's all sorts of different ways of discussing between us, because humans are social animals, so we connect with each other, and somehow the digital thing seems to really work well with cell phones. And so the question is, how can we discuss these issues on these networks, and will it have, you know, what kind of effect will it have?
Yeah.
Because I think the situation of Alaska is really fascinating because, of course, Alaska depends on resources and the fossil fuels make it warm in winter. At the same time, the realization is here that in doing that, one is actually destroying more than Alaska because that, you know, is a big space, but it's actually detrimental to the planet and a lot of other people living in faraway places on the planet. And now we're connecting things. So the oil gets shipped to faraway places, but we're also hearing about the aspirations and interests of other people. And that's a discussion that's definitely happening on the networks.
Mary in Bethel.
And so some of the discussion is how can we... You know, how can we, because we have this discussion and there's all sorts of stories floating around and some are true and some are false and some are, you know, political pressure and so on. So what are the principles of stories that don't completely neglect science? Because these are cultural things. It's about preferences. It's about justice. It's about feeling included, about feeling part of your nation or your culture or your tribe. And And how do we connect that? Because all those stories, I think, are not really responsible anymore if they don't have some pay some attention to what science is telling us, because science is analytical and it's a valuable tool. But it doesn't warm the heart. The heart is warmed by who we are and who we want to be and who we can be. But we can't construct stories of ourselves, of, you know, what big civilizations we are, without paying some attention to what science is telling us right now.
Well,
so how do we connect those? And how does that happen on that digital network?
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
This is a great moment to bring Hayo Eichen in here, who actually studies sea ice and is located in Fairbanks. Hayo, I'm glad you could join us on the program. Probably enjoying this conversation, and this seemed like the perfect moment for you, because I know you like to work the human element into the hard science.
Hey, good morning, Steve. Good to talk to you. I have to admit I haven't been following for long here, but as you know, one of the things that we're interested in is just seeing how people both in coastal communities and other places respond and adapt to some of the variability and changes that we're seeing along Alaska's coastlines, in particular in regards to sea ice. And sort of as a reflection on last year, 2016, I'm just reminded of some of the observations that had come in early in the year, where people in Tuksuk Bay, some of the areas in the YK region, were just commenting on the lack of sea ice and bay ice, even just along shore, as late as early March. Which, as you and some of the listeners are probably aware, was in part connected to the significant temperature anomaly that we've been seeing in ocean surface waters in the region that has played a significant role, at least early in last year's ice season.
Yeah, and how early it freezes up and how early it breaks up. They're both changing pretty dramatically now, it seems, Hayo.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's one of the big things that you're hearing a lot from both from people who are traveling across the land, industry as well, commenting on how the seasonality, both the shift towards earlier breakup and the trend towards later freeze-up, is starting to impact people as well as operations in a variety of ways. And Mark Johnson here with the College of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences and I actually just completed a study late last year where we looked at how satellite data combined with some of these observations from coastal communities can help us track changes in that seasonality, both the shift towards earlier breakup and later freeze-up. And what's interesting is that, you know, apart from the fact that throughout Alaska you have significant trends with several days per decade shift towards earlier breakup and later freeze-up, but in addition, we're now also starting to slowly migrate into a regime where even the wintertime ice conditions are such that the later freeze-up makes use of the ice quite challenging, where you have significant thinning of the ice cover, lack of stability of coastal ice, and that, of course, is important from a number of perspectives. So that's an interesting and important development, I think, that we're starting to see now.
Yeah, we, you know, just a few days ago, we had a storm surge warning for Golovin. Golovin.
Yeah.
Supposed to be frozen.
Yeah.
Can you stay with us for a second, Hayo?
Sure.
All right. I'd like to have you speak with Marion Bethel when Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
the 2017 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms available at bpteachers.com. If you're a rural Alaska resident with an interest in preserving subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing for future generations, Consider applying for a seat on a Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. Deadline is Friday, February 3rd, 2017. More at 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by your Federal Subsistence Board and the U.S. Departments of the Interior and Agriculture.
Well, we're at the end of the Holocene, but are we going to perpetuate our interglacial to the point where there's a whole other, we don't have a glacial anymore? We're not interglacial. It's over. Could be. We're doing that. We're on our way to doing that anyway. Let's go to Mary. Joins the program from Bethel. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Mary.
Thank you. I'm glad you're having this show because, you know, way back in 1994, I took two students from Chivac for a weather camp which concerned global warming. And it was like really, really hard to believe that Even scientists were denying it, and I've lived in Alaska all my life, and I'm one of those people who's very, very observant of everything, and I'm also good in the so-called traditional science as well as the Western sciences. And it's really interesting what the Native people have always observed and said and passed on. And these things, they even predicted the weather changes. And so, like, even as late as 2015, there were still people who were denying that global warming was happening. But you know, like, when we're really trying to find solutions to changes, sometimes I think it's better to not to try to bring things back to the way they were, because that will never happen, as nothing is ever constant. Everything is always changing. So it seems like that the better approach would be to how to live with this change, or to find solutions to living with the change, to lessen all the problems, the social problems, et cetera. And I have one thing about people coming up to Alaska. I've been in Alaska for 5 years, and like to know all the problems about Alaska and all the solutions. You know, like, some people just talk too much. They don't listen. It's really more beneficial to any researcher to do your own research, and always have an open mind. And don't come to do your research thinking that you have all the solutions and that you know everything from the past, because it takes very, very special people to be like that. But you know what? I do learn a lot from listening to talk shows, doing my own research. But some of the most fascinating things that I've ever learned come from little kids, even in preschool. And like, oh my God. And then it's like, I like any research done that includes all ages, because that way we work together, and that way we don't miss something. And anyway, I get so excited about scientific things that sometimes when I'm attempting to talk, I'm so excited I don't even make sense to myself sometimes.
Mary, I think you made a heck of a lot of sense. I really think you did, especially about including, you know, all ages. Yes. And, you know, when you talk about native science, you know, I think there is such a thing. I think, Hiawaikan, you would agree with me there. Wouldn't you?
There is.
Yes.
Just to chime in on that, Mary and Steve, that was very very well put. And I liked several things you emphasized. One is you mentioned the fact that people in these communities, in particular people with indigenous knowledge or sometimes referred to as traditional knowledge, observe a variety of things and see connections between changes in the environment that even researchers may not be able to pick up. A lot of us who are academically trained focus on a specific discipline, and in doing that, you become expert in oftentimes a very narrow subject area, which allows you to dig in deep. But I recall, you know, several of the Nupik and Yupik people that I've learned from, you know, taking in a whole bunch of different things all at the same time, you know, whether it relates to changes on the land, not just in terms of snow cover or vegetation, but also the seasonal migration of animals, seeing that link to changes in the coastal ocean. And in particular, as you start to deal with, well, how do you respond to all of those changes, something that Mary also referred to, I think that broader understanding of how these different processes or different things are actually interrelated, both through the climate system, through the environment, and through a range of other processes, that's an important thing to keep in mind.
Thank you, Hiawaikan. We're running out of time, ma'am. I want to thank you for that, though. That was great, and I really appreciated the few callers we were able to get in. Wolfgang Lucht, I wanted to close with you over there in Potsdam, listening to people telling their stories from Alaska, and having mentioned that you think that personal narratives can be a really important part of efforts to reorient ourselves towards how we're going to deal with this changing climate.
Yes, for me, it's been a huge privilege to be able to be part of this this hour we had. It's very fascinating and excellent contributions.
Okay,
I mean,
we're out of time, though.
As I just said, we scientists are sometimes
thank you,
what we do.
That's all the time we got. Thank you.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Anchorage and Fairbanks to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
If you have an opinionated teenager in your home who thrives on proving a point, check out the Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future Scholarship Competition, organized by UAA's Seawolf Debate Program. More than $10,000 in prizes will be awarded. Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future gives the next generation of Alaskans a voice in the direction of our state. Contest details available at debatingakfuture.com. This message sponsored by Seawolf Debate. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.